Thank you, Cheryl. And thank you all for coming. I'm dazzled. I mean, it's like waiting for the train to depart, and the train departs on time. I've never had that happen in North America. I've experienced it in the UK and in Europe, but not in North America. Probably most of you are familiar with Masterpiece Theater on PBS.
Yes.
You know, the norm is the word from our sponsor. Actually, there are two sponsors. This is one, and it doesn't even really show the real sponsor. My publisher for the book on Cape Breton, which appeared last year, Cape Breton University Press. And the other sponsor that I should make reference to, I'm sorry I don't have something to leave in print, but it will be available probably up in the main floor. Their sort of public notice desk will have information about the seniors' college programs here in Metro for, I think they're calling it the winter semester. Anyway, the batch of offerings after Christmas, starting in the latter part of January. And I'll be doing for the seniors' college a 6-week course on railway history of, in theory, of Nova Scotia. Exactly how it'll be organized, that'll sort of depend on who's there and what interests are. But if what you hear and see today triggers any interest, then you might be in, at least most of you, are in the appropriate demographic for that program. The tentative plan is that will be at the Kesham Goodman Library on Monday mornings, starting the last Monday in January. Although that's tentative scheduling, subject to possible change. Okay. I reread shortly before leaving home this morning the little blurb, and it seemed to suggest that we're going to do Halifax as terminus from, what did we say, Cheryl? 1850? From the beginning, anyway.
1854
question.
To 2013.
Yeah, I was afraid of that. 1854. that's a tall order at best, and unless we take a break for mid-afternoon lunch and finish around 5 o'clock, and I don't imagine anybody had that as an intention. So I'm going to ask a question. And I should actually, how to put this so you know how to respond properly. What I want to get a sense of is where interests lie, whether it be, let's say, in the 19th century up to the First World War. That's sort of option one. Or the more modern period, i.e. 1900 to today. So, front end, historically speaking, or more recent period. And you can only vote for one. Okay? So how many of you would be more interested in the front end, in the earlier period? Okay, and the more recent's have it. All right, because I've got a folder of illustrations here that I can maneuver through. I don't have a script. The script is there and here and inspiration of the moment, or lack thereof. So we can try to make front end light. I'm sort of disappointed in that, because tell the truth, I'm really more interested in early period. Hey, you're the audience, so we try to respond to that. But despite the interest in the more modern period, we've got to deal with where railways start. Now, they don't really start with Joe Howe. But in terms of Nova Scotia, how ranks front and center? How ranks front and center in so many things in terms of 19th century Nova Scotia? Journalism, politics, legal affairs, the question of the botheration scheme, yay or nay, confederation, but also railways. Those of you who are at the front get the bonus, the one that I brought as a handout prepared, which has two sides. So I'm going to ask you to start circulating that and go along the back. And Cheryl, if you would take the single page, which has the quotes from Howe. Well, maybe I should have one of these myself. Railways, horse-powered railways initially, and then powered by steam locomotives, become significant in Britain in the late 1820s, early 1830s. In Nova Scotia, same time frame applies, not Halifax. Pictou County and Cape Breton in the mining settings. The province's original railways, regardless of how you define railway, appear as adjuncts to the operations of the General Mining Association and its coal mines in what was then Albion Mines, what is now Stellarton, or in Sydney Mines, with a couple of smaller ones in Bridgeport, close to Glace Bay, and Bredore on the north side of Sydney Mines. At that point in time, Howe was starting as a journalist. And he got the railway bug. That's the only way to describe it. He had not seen anything except for the beginning of the horse-powered line in Stellarton. When he made a trip to Pictou County that was part of the series that were called his Eastern Rambles that appeared in the Nova Scotian in the early 1830s. But as a journalist, Howe was in receipt of newspapers with increasing numbers of accounts and descriptions of what was happening in the appearance of railways in both England and New England. For railways were starting to appear in increasing numbers after 1830, going inland from ports like Portland, Boston, Providence, New York, and so on, going into the hinterland to develop trade and bring trade into the port cities. And Howe realized, this is something that provides an opportunity for Halifax. Now, in one sense, this realization on Howe's part was application of an idea that had been put out by another group here in Halifax, the folks who advocated and started construction of the Shubenacadie Canal to link Halifax Harbor to Grand Lake, Shubenacadie River, and downstream to Minas Basin. The core objective of that was to draw trade from inland and ultimately from the area of the Annapolis Valley, particularly the coastal communities along the Minas Basin shore, into Halifax. Howe's idea was that, but do it via rail. And that first quote in the run of three by Howe from 1835, the executive summary of that six or seven lines, I wanted you to have the original, but essentially a railway that connects Halifax to Windsor and then ultimately beyond would bring the trade from that part of the province into Halifax, because the trade from that part of the province at that point in time was going by sea, call minus base sea, by water to St. John, New Brunswick. And Howe's interest was in drawing it in to the Halifax merchant community. he never lost the idea of railways, but very quickly came to realize that, you know, the potential impact of railways could go far beyond drawing trade from Windsor and Kentville and down that shore, or Truro and Picton. In the 1840s, in England, you initially had a British origin for a scheme called the Halifax and Quebec, which is something that you might have heard reference to. Thinking bigger, not Halifax to Truro, but Halifax to the interior. I'm going to skip a couple here because we've got to get to the modern period. Along with how another critical name in terms of impact on Eastern Canada is this guy, John A. Poor, originally from Bangor, who wound up as a young man setting up his legal offices in Portland, Maine, and who was in the 1840s a railway promoter par excellence. Poor and his associates in Portland wanted to do what Howe was thinking about for Portland. Go north and draw the trade from Montreal, the St. Lawrence Valley, and the trade that was starting to come from Ontario, New York State, via the lakes, and make Portland the port that would serve that vast area of the interior. Part of Poor's ideas came to fruition, and the result was what became the Grand Trunk. It actually started as the St. Lawrence and Atlantic from Montreal to Portland, Maine, but was by the time it was ready to start operating, it had been taken over by the Grand Trunk Railway, which was running from essentially along the St. Lawrence Valley and the northern side of Lake Ontario. The Grand Trunk's core route in Canadian terms was Rivière-du-Loup, Quebec, on the St. Lawrence, Levy, Montreal, Cornwall, Kingston, Toronto, and down to the American border. That had implications for Halifax. Serious implications for Halifax. Because the Grand Trunk, with their extension to Portland, provided an alternative to Halifax as an outlet for Canadian trade, or for trade coming in by boat, destined for Upper Canada. And everybody here seen Michael DeGatter's "You Must Be a Nova Scotian If"? Mm-hmm. You remember that toward the back, there's the one, "You're a Nova Scotian if Upper Canada is everything west of New Brunswick." Going to skip these folks. The scheme to connect Portland to Halifax collapsed. Howe was involved in trying to get financing. British government wasn't forthcoming. There wasn't agreement among the Canadian provinces. New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, Canada couldn't come to terms about route or how to handle the financing. So Howe, in the early 50s, by this time he was in government, said, "All right, we got to start here," and start here he did. The Nova Scotia Railway, Howe's line to Windsor, and with the fork at Windsor Junction going north to Truro. This is the announcement from the Nova Scotian, 1858 December, the opening of service from Halifax to Truro. The Windsor branch had opened about 6-7 months before. Down at the bottom, James McNab, chairman. The Tories won the election in 1857. Howe, as chair of the Board of Railway Commissioners and member of the cabinet in that capacity, were out. The appointees were out. The Conservatives took over, but the railway continued as a provincial government operation. And that's why I included the second quote, because in a nutshell, that second quote from Howe about Windsor and the Windsor branch from 1850, pointing out his contention that Private ownership, particularly private ownership from away, from Britain. Construction by British contractors was not to be trusted for various reasons. And the Nova Scotia Railway, under Howe, was built and operated as what we would call a Crown Corporation. One of the first examples of a Crown Corp in British North America, owned and operated by the provincial government. On that period, I brought along a couple of books to sort of wave at you, both of which are in the library here. This one's still on the shelf in the bookstores. I'm not sure about the second one. Jay Underwood, who's from Elmsdale, and in interest of full disclosure, is a good friend of mine, called From Folly to Fortune. It's really about the chief engineer who directed the construction in the core phase, James Richardson Foreman. Halifax born, trained in the UK, a civil engineer, brought back by Howe in 1854 to direct the construction of the Nova Scotia Railway, and did that job until the change of government, at which point in time he was given the heave-ho along with anybody and everybody else who was deemed to be liberal. The Foreman family, well known in Halifax, James Richardson Foreman's father was chief cashier of the Bank of Nova Scotia, looked after the books. I wouldn't say anything more than that. The Bank of Nova Scotia survived, but not by that much. There's a biography of Foreman Sr. done by Pam Lotz. You know, probably 20, 25 years ago. Again, it's in the library upstairs. One of the more famous embezzlement cases in Nova Scotia's history. Okay, one other guy we've got to include here before we get more modern. The photos from the McCordon in Montreal. When Confederation took place, the Windsor branch was deemed to be sort of superfluous because the routing for the intercolonial that would connect Nova Scotia and New Brunswick to Upper Canada was based on the Nova Scotia Railway's branch to Truro, and then you build north. So what to do with the orphan Windsor branch? The provincial government wasn't interested in carrying it on, and a deal was struck with a British company to whom the Windsor branch would be leased if the British company were to extend further down the valley. The result of that was the Windsor and Annapolis. And this guy is Vernon Smith, who was, again, engineer, directed the project of constructing the Windsor and Annapolis, starting in the late 60s. There was a very impressive memorial to Smith unveiled in Wolfville about a month and a half ago. Any of you see press coverage of that? Simply as railway engineer, because from after the Windsor and Annapolis job, he went south. And did similar work on what was called the Western Counties Railway, which started in Yarmouth, building eastward. The result of the two was the Dominion Atlantic, feeding Howe's idea from the 1830s, bringing trade of the entire strip along the coast of Bay of Fundy, Minas Basin, into Halifax. Smith, I think, was the guy who did something else. This is one of the projects I've got going. You can't really see this well. This is one of the first three locomotives that came from England. I'm reasonably confident that it was Smith who determined where they would come from. That's not relevant. But what was interesting about the engines was the names. This is Gabriel, number two, on the Windsor and Annapolis. Number three was Blomidon. Number one had the most interesting name of all. Any guesses?
Evangeline.
Evangeline. And I don't have enough other than the beginnings of the work on this, but it's my instinctive sense, my guess at this point in time, so I think it's a good one, that Vernon Smith was the guy who thought in terms of the railway from Yarmouth into Halifax being something that would be the base for promotion of development of what we would now call the tourist industry. And the target was New England. And bringing folks from Boston, where the story of Evangeline had become, over the previous couple of decades, a bestseller. And the Windsor and Annapolis, and then subsequently the DAR, here you have. The identification is here. This is W&A, 1880s. There was a book about 80 pages, lots of photographs. Come to Nova Scotia, the land of Evangeline. And it's something that was used by the railways into the Canadian Pacific days, into the 1960s, to promote tourism and bring the Americans, and don't forget your money. Along with that, as part of the package, you know, they had their interest in shipping, hotels, coming to Halifax, the Lord Nelson, built in 1929 by the DAR, which in fact was Canadian Pacific. The target was to make Halifax the easternmost terminus for the tourist industry. Okay, now I'm going to take a peek at. I said I don't have a script here. I got a list of my files. Where do we want to go next? Well, the DAR route. We can sort of capture the other side. In the 1890s. You have a number of small projects, one here, that get consolidated into, as the DAR consolidated the lines on this shore, these got consolidated into the Halifax and Southwestern. Mackenzie and Mann, who were major national railway contractors, best known for the Canadian Northern, which ran across the country to their terminus in Prince Rupert, British Columbia. The prime target was Winnipeg to Prince Rupert. And then for the Cape, is there more than one Cape Bretoner in the house? There's at least one back there who I've known from previous lives. Mackenzie and Mann also were the initially the contractors for and became the owners of the Inverness and Richmond from Point Tupper up the shore, Mabu, Judick, Port Hood, to Inverness. Also, the indication is that what was the real interest there was not, in fact, the railway, but coal. Donald Mann was described by one biographer as a prospector at heart, and many of their railway projects were targeted to provide transport for mineral developments. And this applied, in fact, from Cape Breton through to British Columbia. But the Halifax and Southwestern brought the trade of this area and the cross line that went from Bridgewater across and then down the Digby Neck to into Halifax. Okay, let's get back to sort of the core, the intercolonial. The Nova Scotia Railway Confederation, one of the terms of the deal that made New Brunswick and Nova Scotia sign was the promise to construct, as a government project, a railway that would connect Halifax with Upper Canada. The actual connection point from the outset was targeted to be the Grand Trunk's easternmost terminal at Rivière-du-Loup. And over the period between the late 60s and 1876, when the job was done, that was the focus. This wonderful drawing appeared on the front cover of a journal called the Canadian Illustrated News in July of 1876. Fast freight train for Halifax. Here we've got the Citadel, Quebec City, in the background. So we're on the Levy Shore. And which way is the train going? It's coming east. Carrying upper Canadian goods. This was not what the Maritimers had in mind. Their focus was on stuff from down here, from Nova Scotia and New Brunswick, going west. When it was drawn by the artist, I don't think it was intended to have great political or economic foresight. It was probably a result of the fact that they wanted to have the Citadel in the background here. It was a nice artistic gimmick, but the reality was that it had long-run significance as a measure of what the intercolonial ultimately became. Despite the theory, despite the intentions, it wound up primarily becoming a road that carried goods from Upper Canada into the Maritimes. That's long run. Railways did other things as well. I mean, they carried mail, passengers, of course. With the development of the concentrated telegraph system capacity that the railways initially used for internal purposes, they became the operators of public telegraph system. Money orders, you wanted to transfer funds and you didn't have a bank account, it was the common process to get a railway money order, handle goods collect, COD shipments from Eaton's to every rural or urban station in the Maritimes became one of the major parts of goods handled by the railways. For a couple of decades, we had a cottage over on the North Shore, close to Tanmagush, and I think it was probably the first summer that we were there, we made a stop into a little facility called the Fraser Center, which is an art gallery, community center, mini museum and archive in Tanmagush. And at that point in time, the station had just been closed. And I asked if, by any chance, they had anything in the way of records, or if they'd all gone off to Moncton and ultimately to the repository of CN archives in Ottawa. They had a couple of boxes of what they described as junk that got salvaged from the station in Tanmagush. One of the pieces of junk was a stack of invoices, waybills, from the early 1950s, about yay thick, or about 130, 140. And okay, have a look at them. Lo and behold, this was incoming freight and express. Over half of them had shipments from Eaton's warehouse in Moncton. Everything you could imagine in terms of descriptions of the actual nature of the goods, but indicating the impact that the railway as carrier and many of them also, I'd forgotten the exact count, but somewhere around half of the Eaton shipments were COD, collect on delivery, pay the freight, so that somebody could order it without having to make the advance payment of the shipping charge. But then you had other things, like Barnum Circus. This is also 1876. P.T. Barnum's three monster special railway trains. These actually didn't come the intercolonial route. They came across from Maine, where the rail connection had been opened across the border at Vanceboro McAdam, through St. John, played St. John, Moncton, probably Amherst, did play in Truro, and then 3 days here in Halifax. Circus trains remain part of the peripheral benefit of the railway network into the 1950s. And this one, just as a reminder, Montreal to Portland, the St. Lawrence and Atlantic, the Atlantic and St. Lawrence on the American side of the frontier, which became the Grand Trunk. This is in the background. Operational in 1853. 20 years before the intercolonial comes all the way through. And during that 20-year period, the Grand Trunk did things like construct grain elevators in Portland. And Portland was, by 1876, in fact, the winter port for Montreal, regardless of the hopes of Nova Scotians who had supported the idea of the intercolonial, or the politicians who had signed off on the deal, or intercolonial management. The folks who were responsible for running the ICR did their best to try and offset, but the combination of distance and the impact on freight rates, even with capacity to have a freight rate system that provided for cheaper rates to benefit maritime shippers, it did not do anything to diminish the capacity of Portland to capture trade coming from the interior, which at this point in time was still Western Ontario, through to the docks of Portland rather than to the docks of Halifax. Here's the ICR as it existed just before the turn of the century. Here we got the main line, which followed the original route provided for or required by the British government to get British guarantee for financing going basically the North Shore. This wasn't to follow the coast. The fact that it was along the coast is immaterial. It was the furthest possible distance to New Brunswick from the American border. That was the essence of the location. Going back to the days of the Halifax and Quebec scheme, when surveys for potential routes had been done, the word from London was always, consistently, if this is going to happen, and if it's going to have support of the British government financially, approval of the British government during the colonial era, then safety from those guys. Because the fear of possibility of American attack was something that was still in the minds of people even after the American Civil War. When we get to Halifax, it was not, in fact, just Halifax that was a terminal. The other side, Darkest Dartmouth, as Haligonians are inclined to call the side of the harbor that's home to me, Darkest Dartmouth was also part of the network. And by times, there were thoughts that Dartmouth was the obvious location for the development of new shipping terminals. The initial rail connection was, in fact, by bridge. This is the original harbor bridge. This is the Dartmouth shoreline here, the basin's up here, with a swing section that has been described by some people as having been the first railway swing bridge, iron swing bridge, that was built in North America. I'm not sure if that's in fact true or not. No warranty on that. The bridge was opened in 18... This is the first one, opened in 1884. And it lasted for 7 years. It wasn't particularly well built. And maybe it's a miracle that it lasted for 7 years. Came down in a big storm. It was replaced by a second bridge, which lasted only 1 year. And at that point in time, they came to the conclusion, maybe this is not a good idea. And so the line was built from Windsor Junction on dry land down into along the edge of the shoreline and into downtown Dartmouth. Railway basis, a railway terminus, is one that often is the location for not just things like roundhouses and machine shops and so on that would maintain railway equipment. They could also be a base for manufacture of stuff for railways. Stuff can run the gamut from anything as small as you can imagine to rolling stock and locomotives. There in fact was a locomotive builder going back into early days. He was in business in the late 60s with a foundry. And they constructed 7 engines. And this was long before the Nova Scotia Railway was into downtown Halifax. The original terminal was out basically just facing the edge of the container pier at Fairview Cove. But William Montgomery, whose base of operations was down at the end of Barrington Street, the Shebucto Foundry, and it became the Nova Scotia Iron Works, decided he was going to have a go at building locomotives. There was a company in St. John, New Brunswick, that had started building engines for the European and North American, the New Brunswick equivalent of the Nova Scotia Railway. They at least were actually adjacent to the railway line. Montgomery's foundry, the one building of which survives. You're familiar with the... Can you mentally walk down Barrington to the end, the south end? It's red sandstone building that's now, in fact, been turned into a church. And that was part of the Montgomery foundry where locos were built. He went bust. The latter part of the order of locomotives for the intercolonial that he had started was actually completed. The work was finished at the intercolonial shops out in Richmond. Siliker was the other Halifax example of a company that attempted to get into the rolling stock market. You had a number of car builders in Nova Scotia. If we start on the Cape, the border, Amherst, Rhodes Curry and Company, starting in the 1890s until after World War I, were one of the largest builders of freight cars in Canada. Not just for local railways, but going right across the country for the Canadian Pacific, for the Canadian Northern, for lines in the northwestern U.S. Turned out, nobody knows really how many they turned out, because many of the records have not survived, but perhaps somewhere in the range of 10,000-20,000. Just before World War I, Rhodes had a workforce of something approaching 2,000 people. They didn't just do freight cars, they also built stations for the intercolonial throughout the Maritimes, and a number of the surviving ones. For example, the Railway Museum at Orangedale in Cape Breton is in the original intercolonial station built as the ICR line was being built through to Sydney. Dates from 1889, probably, maybe 1890, built by Rhodes Curry of Moncton. Then the other one was the division of Nova Scotia Steel and Coal in Trenton, which stayed in business until relatively recently. Siliker and Rhodes Curry did not make the transition from building wooden freight cars to steel. And that was the factor that meant early demise for both Siliker and Rhodes shortly after the First World War. The Trenton Works, as a division of what was essentially a coal and steel company, the transition was logical. And they continued to supply cars until probably about 2002, 2003 was the last railway rolling stock that came out of the shops in Trenton. In the 70s, in the 1870s, the Intercolonial gets into downtown Halifax. The map is you can see a date up at the top there, 1894, but the line was punched around the basin and down to the deep water terminals that you can see here, which were about halfway between Purdy's Wharf and the bridge. They were located in the area that would be sort of the southern end of what's now the Navy Dockyard. So if we go from the north, working in this direction, the big new station, Intercolonial Railway Station, at the bottom of North Street. The area occupied by the dockyard was relatively small at that point in time, and then the so-called deep water terminals, a new wharf system and warehouses built to handle ocean trade in significant quantities. Shortly after that, there was a grain elevator built that was about here, just across the street from the deep water terminals. This is a photograph, and you can see that it's identified there as being taken from on top of the grain elevator, looking north. The quality of the image is not great. In fact, it's lousy when you get right down to it. It's the best one I've been able to find of this particular card. But if you're looking at it on the computer screen, where you get better resolution, you can see just here the tower of the North Street Station. The deep water terminals were severely damaged by the explosion, given their location. This is a shot that was taken after the explosion damage had been repaired, and dates from probably 1925-26. And again, the layout showing track access not only alongside but going in as well. The objective of providing as direct a transfer between ship and rail as you could possibly get. There's another version of essentially the same setting, artistic rendering. It's a detail from one of Dusan Cadlec's paintings showing the Halifax waterfront. One of the few that I've seen that in fact is 20th century as opposed to the golden age of sail. He likes sailing ships more than steam locomotives, and yeah, that's understandable. And from an artist's perspective, they're certainly a lot more picturesque. There's the station, North Street. Photograph was taken probably about 1900, 1895, 1900. The station had been opened in 1876. The train sheds went out going north. You're looking at the southern side of the building, the southern facade. The train sheds and the tracks went to the north, with a long roofing system made of glass, where the card here has 60. The actual death toll on the station platforms when the roof came in, the glass roof came in, was something in excess of 100 at the time of the explosion in 1917. And we can't go by the topic of railways and the explosion without at least including a passing peak. Vince Coleman was the intercolonial agent telegrapher at the station at Richmond, who stayed on the job sending telegraph messages to have trains that were inbound from Rockingham, Bedford, heading into Halifax, sending out the message, ship with explosives on fire, stop trains, yada, 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 and he died in the building.
While you're wrapping up in the next 10 minutes, I'm just going to collect people's
paper for
prizes, and for those who didn't get the paper, I'll supply one.
Just before the war, the First World War, the decision had been made to build additional docks in the south end. And they started the process of digging the railway cut through South End Halifax. This is has the local member of Parliament, who was also Prime Minister at the time, Robert Borden, doing inspection. The docks were completed and everything was done, but it didn't really resolve the question of business. And the economic problems of the Maritimes in the 1920s, to a high degree, were centered on things related to railways and railway policy. Among the objectives were fair freight rates. Well, actually, in terms of the Maritimes, what they wanted to do was to undo one of the things that Borden had done, being a Haligonian with interest in Nova Scotia at heart. One of the things the Borden government did was to eliminate the differential freight rates, which made it possible for maritime shippers to ship X pounds of stuff in a wooden box to Montreal for less than a Montreal shipper shipping to Halifax. That had been designed to promote maritime industry. Borden government said, ain't fair. So the so-called maritime differential was eliminated. From the perspective of maritimers, freight rates meant restoration of the differential rates, which had been part of the intercolonial operations from day one. Reasonable express rates. Canadian goods for Canadian ports, our share of Western grain. The impact of 1853 still going on. Despite the construction by the national government of the big grain elevators in the south end, the railways and the port had more than a bit of difficulty in attracting grain trade, one of the things that they desperately wanted to do. The maritime rights movement also had as a general grievance the failure of the railways. Now, by this point in time, the intercolonial had become Canadian national. Same management, which Borden had shifted from Moncton to Upper Canada. The intercolonial headquarters used to be in Moncton. Robert Borden said, no, send it off to Toronto. The railway was seen as a flop in terms of regional promotion. These two cartoons come from the Herald in the mid-20s. I want to show you this one. Halifax as terminus. What all sorts of interesting things came across the docks? The lady boats, which are run by Canadian National, brought bananas and tropical fruit and made Halifax a port for folks going to the Caribbean on cruises. But this is an indicator of one of the more interesting forms of cargo. CN Expressway bill. From Halifax to Ottawa to the Bank of Canada. 11,433 boxes of gold bullion. Each box contained 4 bars, 25 pounds a bar, and those of you who are good at mental math can crank the numbers. Value, 1940, $695 million. 4 trainloads. 2 that departed Halifax on July 13th, 2 that departed Halifax on the following day. Total value, $700 million. If you run the inflation index, it comes out to about $12 billion. If you run the gold price index, because gold then was, the Bank of England price for gold at this point in time was $34.85 US, an ounce. And now $1,300, give or take. That turns the value of those trains, cargoes, into roughly $27 billion. Now, if those weren't targets for local entrepreneurial versions of Jesse James, I don't know what. This of course was not the only one. This is the waybill, which has a whole lot of stuff, 4 trainloads condensed into one. Gold shipments were coming from the fall of 1939. This was a big convoy that came. The dating, of course, is those of you who've got good. Recollection of dates of events of 1940. The last of the British Army was evacuated from Dunkirk the middle of June, at which point in time the question was, when is he coming? Not is he coming, but when is he coming? The fear that Nazi invasion was imminent, and basically what was going on here was that the Bank of England completed the process had been gradually taking place over the previous 10 months of emptying the vaults. The gold was just the tip of the iceberg. They also were carrying tremendous cargoes of securities, bonds, shares, anything convertible into Canadian, Australian, American dollars came to Canada for safekeeping, for preparation for transfer and sale in New York, turn it into cash. Because at this point in time, Britain was still having to get a significant part of the military aid from the United States on a cash and carry basis. And this is one of the critical parts of the cash. Inside the station, 1943, Bob Chambers. One of a series of sketches that he did in wartime. So let's jump. Post-war. When all said and done, this is probably, from the vantage point of the Port of Halifax, the most significant thing. Containers. Bulk cargo, and it's not just Halifax, but in the shipping business around the world, bulk cargo essentially disappears. This is a photograph that I took from the other book I wanted to make reference. And it's got good coverage of this entire sweep of Halifax as a railway terminus, as a port, and the trials and tribulations of trying to attract or retain traffic, and the implications of that for the development of the railway system. Jim Frost's Canada's Atlantic Gateway, Illustrated History of the Port of Halifax. Published about 6-7 years ago by Nimbus. The photograph could have been done black and white, could have been done this morning, except for the fact that down here you see DART, which is one of the originals And this, in fact, was taken in 1969, marking the beginnings of serious transfer over Halifax dockside and by rail out of Halifax or to Halifax of containers. And Halifax, in terms of handling container traffic, is given credit by Frost, and I have no reason to question his reliability on this score. The first of the North American ports where containers were transferred directly from railway flat car to ship by use of crane. There had been a container port established in Quebec City earlier, but they weren't doing direct transfer. Why, I don't know. And it's such an obvious thing to do. This is a small, primitive system compared to the big gantries that you find either at Halterm or Fairview Cove now. But the basic idea is the critical thing.
We're just at one. We're going to have people, I know, that need to leave.
Passenger traffic, well, there was still a shed in the 1970s. There ain't any more. Bruce McKinnon, 1990. For card-carrying members of the Conservative Party. Is that a political statement? Yeah. Now, the same thing would apply in later years in regard to railway policy with Jean Chrétien or Paul Martin or any of the subsequent pretenders to the position of Prime Minister. Government financing support for public transportation has since the 1970s gone down, and from the mid-70s on, in terms of passenger traffic, everything was lumped under Via Rail, and Via paid the political price. McKinnon captured it pretty well. I think I can, but they couldn't. This was taken in Sydney in 1990, when the process of the cuts to everything except for the service, passenger service from Halifax to Montreal was completed. As at that date, you could get on passenger cars in a number of locations, but they weren't going to go anywhere. They were strictly in museums. Most recently, we've had the second to last, when VIA service has been cut from 6 days a week to three. This was Deatter's cartoon that actually related to, I think it was the announcement about Acadian that triggered this. He will be able to recycle this. And notwithstanding the fact that you've got some handouts here from VIA Rail about the wonders of their service, use it soon.
Yeah.
Because that one is going to come into effect.
And this is a good segue.
Probably soon.
Our door prizes supplied by